It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, Joanna Stein. She's a writer and a comedian, and her most recent YouTube video went viral with over 2.5 million hits, which landed her a CBS sitcom deal. Now, how often does that happen? You put up a video that you made in your living room, and a little bit later on, less than a week later, you get a sitcom deal from CBS. Well, Joanna's going to come and join us and tell the whole story. And it's quite a story because she's been at it for 20 years. It seems like an overnight sensation, but it was not so. Before we do that, as always, I'd like to thank my sponsor, Karen Hartwick, over at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Some of the finest teas from around the world. You can get them at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. That's the website. Or just drop in if you're in Stratford for a tea tasting. I'm tasting. I like Darjeeling tea. So right now I'm tasting this tea that she gave me. It's called Glenburn First Flush Darjeeling Tea. And it's really, really nice and light. So Glenburn, that's the estate, Glenburn Estates. It's on a plantation on the banks of the River Runjeet, high in the Himalayan mountains over in India. And of course, Karen's visited India and visited many, many estates. And the first flush, the first flush part of the title of the tea, that refers to when the tea was harvested. So this tea was harvested in mid-March, just following the spring rains. So the tea has a gentle, light color. And it's not as astringent as a Darjeeling, say, that was picked in the autumn, right? That'll be a bit heavier and a bit darker. This is a bit lighter. And I love Darjeelings. So when I told her I try not to get too, you know, I'm not that fond of the really black tea. So this is a perfect compromise. You can find out more. Order, hey, good time, Christmas coming up, perfect Christmas gift. Give her a call. Her number's at StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Karen Hartwick, she's Canada's tea sommelier. Okay, today's show, Joanna Stein. I first met her over 20 years ago. I was at the Fringe Festival in Winnipeg, living there at the time in Winnipeg, and we caught up. We have similar senses of humors. And then not long after that, she went to L.A., and we kind of lost touch, but we reconnected for the episode. And as you know, the story, she put a video up on YouTube. Some of the contents of the YouTube video was drawn from a book she had published, so we'll talk about that. And despite the fact that she spends so much of her time of her writing, acting is actually one of her favorite things to do. She talks about that on the podcast, but it doesn't square with the lifestyle, especially when you're a parent. It's really difficult to find, you know, the time to be with your kid if you're on the road doing a show. So she talks about that paradox in her life. And of course, the video wouldn't have happened without her child. And Joanna and I are both parents of an only child. So naturally, we discuss parenting and its implications on the creative process. But as I said, before she made this video that went viral, she wrote a book. And that's where we start off with our discussion.
Hey, I've known you for over 20 years. Yeah. And I just have to get this off my chest that I think Tina Fey stole your luck. Let's get that out of the way right now.
God bless you. Yeah.
It's true. Do people say that? Oh, you look like Tina Fey.
I get it. People will say all the... I mean, now it's gotten to a point where people will say, does anyone ever tell you? And I'll go, Tina Fey.
Yeah.
Yes. I like to say that I'm the low rent Tina Fey.
Well, that's changing, you know.
I'm the mid rent. Still low rent Tina Fey.
You're moving up in the world. Let's go way back to just to folks who haven't read the book. Yeah. The book, How Not to Calm a Child on a Plane and Other Lessons in Parenting from a Highly Questionable, that would be you, source. Mm-hmm. So in that title story, your toddler decides, you and your husband are at the airport and you're going to go on a plane, and your toddler decides that she's not boarding the plane. She screams and cries, you know, mm-hmm. like toddlers do.
Yep.
And then you kind of use your feminine ways to talk a ticketing agent into giving you the very much coveted bulkhead seats. Mm-hmm. And then you end up thinking, oh, it was my charms and flirting with the agent that got me the greatest seats on the airplane. Right, but I love the moment where your husband, because that's me, points out that the ticketing agent is probably gay.
Sure.
And he just took pity on you and the screaming child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now that's a crushing moment in a young mother's life, right? Especially a first-time mother. And then the story gets worse because you come along the air sickness bag and everything. But when did you discover your ability to take these sort of everyday moments and blow them up in writing? When did you first realize you had that talent?
Well, thanks for saying that. You know, I've been writing comedy for a long time, since way back, since we knew each other back in the 1920s. And I've always really enjoyed absurdist comedy, you know, just really physical stuff I've always really liked.
Are we talking Three Stooges, like in high school, or like when did you?
I would say more Monty Python, Second City, SCTV. I've always really loved really broad comedy. So that was kind of my wheelhouse for the longest time. And I even attempted to do stand-up, but my stand-up was always a step or two removed from me personally. It was never very personal things until I had a kid.
Yeah.
And it really was just that suddenly I had something I really wanted to talk about, and it just kind of started oozing out. And it also, I found myself for the first time in a long time engaged in this activity, experience that was very foreign to me and that I had a lot of conflicting feelings about, a lot of fears. So it really was just that I had this a huge nugget, a huge part of my life became noteworthy or, you know, writing worthy. It was just something I kind of wanted to talk about. And there were feelings going on, like, you know, I've written about this, that feeling of just really wanting to push on the soft spot on her head. Which is so creepy. You know, it's funny, though. I do talk to, and maybe this is more an indicator of the kinds of people I hang out with, but when I talk to other new moms or, you know, moms who've got two-year-old kids, we all have that sort of, we kind of talk about that dirty secret of like, oh, my God, I can't believe I didn't kill the baby today. I'm so excited.
Exactly.
I didn't drop the baby. So, like, my thing was, in addition to wanting to press on the soft, I never did, by the way. I did not press on the soft spot on her head. But I had that, just that lingering fear. You're alone with your baby and you're reading the news and you read about those stories, whether it's someone who left their kid in a hot car or someone who suddenly snapped. And you're in this, you know, you're in this weird sleepless mode and you start thinking, well, how do I know that's not going to happen to me? You know, we lived in a high-rise apartment in Chicago at the time and we had to throw our garbage down a garbage chute. And I had to say literally to my husband once, like, you do the garbage throwing out because I don't want to be that person who one day just accidentally mistook the old chicken carcass for the baby and I throw my baby down the garbage chute.
I know, because I might, when we had Cole, we decided that I'd be the primary child giver. My wife was a teacher and she did the work and I worked out of the house. So I totally get exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
That sleep deprivation is not, you know, I'd be lying, you know, when Cole was like 1.5, I'd get him, I wanted to watch some YouTube, some videos, sit him on my lap, watch, you know, Wilco, and I realized, oh, okay, at least this is actually not so bad. He's getting into some good music, but you know, every moment you realize, is this good or bad? And it, but did you have that other thing that comes with that? Is it that demand from the child prevents you from doing your work?
Yeah. Yes, that's true.
That's true. Yeah, of course it's true.
It is true. I mean, this whole like, conversation about having it all is such baloney. You know, you can have it all, like, over the course of your life, maybe you can have it all, but like at any given time, you know, you're not firing, for me anyway, I'm never firing on all cylinders at the same time. But,
and then the worst part is then you have, you know, then you, so your baby is your primary focus and that's great. And then you realize, oh, my professional life is dying now. I can't, yeah. I was doing my master's degree. I couldn't write a master's thesis in between, you know, feedings or in between sleeping or whatever. So you just go, you get frustrated there.
Yeah. Well, we lived in Los Angeles for a long time. We had the kid. And then when she was about a year old, my husband got offered a job in Chicago. And we took it because I was in that mode of like, well, I'm a mom right now. I'm focusing on the baby and, you know, he's got this good gig that just came up. Great. Let's go check it out. And
meanwhile, you're giving away everything you worked up so hard in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because we definitely talked a lot about that and I still worked a bit. Part of me thought, well, maybe I'll love it. Maybe I'll love being a full-time mom. Maybe I'll never want to go back to writing. And wouldn't that be amazing? If I'm totally fulfilled doing that, great. Let's see what happens. You know, and it really, what happened was I didn't have the same creative outlets in Chicago. And so I started writing. I kind of had to write these essays. It was one of the only ways to get my creative yayas out.
So being that's interesting. So it was almost like a self-imposed exile or a self-imposed retreat.
Yeah.
And you didn't have that creative circle of people physically near you, and you just sort of communicated with them and with your ideas on paper.
Yeah. Actually, in a weird way, it was one of the best things that's happened to me creatively was leaving Los Angeles. You know, my writing focus completely changed and shifted. And of course, I was building on stuff I learned before that. So not to say that everything out that came before that was useless or a waste of time. It wasn't. Everything, you know, so it's just all just constant building. But
I love what you said earlier about your writing actually for the first time became, you didn't use the word truthful, but to me it's, and this is all the cliche, right, what you know and everything, but it sounds like having that time alone and being so engrossed in the parenting process and all the questions that go along with that, and then you were able to distill that into something on the page. Whereas your writing before was almost broader, like Monty Python, and sort of on the outside looking in.
Very much so.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely, yeah. Comedy for comedy's sake. And now I write more, you know, to me, when I write a piece now, the first time I'll write a piece, I'm not even writing any jokes. Like, it's not to be funny. I'm writing to figure out what I'm thinking about something. And I, you know, I write longhand. I it's a complete mess. But I really am just trying to dredge my brain to go, how do I really feel about this? And, you know, as creepy as it might get, or as gross as I might get, or, you know, I don't censor it at all. Whereas when in my other kind of writing, you know, previous stuff.
Sure. You're writing jokes.
Yeah, it's the complete opposite. It would be, oh my God, I have a funny notion, or, you know, if I have an idea for something I want to do on stage. I have this, I want to build a nude suit because that's funny to me. How can I justify it? And I'm also not shitting on that kind of process either. I think that's
for sure,
totally
yeah.
valid. And I've had some of the funnest, most interesting creative times doing that stuff too. But definitely this is just it's exercising different areas in my comedy brain.
And I guess you feel you've got more, you know, something that's always important for creative folks, especially anyone who has something to say is the creative control. Do you find you have more creative control in writing for a novel or writing for your blog than you have writing in it? Because you've written for Disney shows, you've written for Carsey Warner shows. So talk about the difference between writing on a TV show where it is for laughs and doing something for yourself.
Yeah, great question.
You probably felt more confident in that TV world where there's a group of people and there's a process.
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's the stakes are so much higher. I'm really conscious of when I'm working on a show that, you know, I have a big responsibility to all these people and to the money that they're spending to make the show. It's a business. And so it's a job. And when I feel like I'm not delivering, it's terrible. It's a horrible feeling. When I'm not, you know, if I feel like I can't really nail a piece in a essay or something or a video, whatever, who cares? It's just,
right.
You know, maybe I'll embarrass myself. That would suck. But I don't like, you know, I don't like the feeling of not being able to deliver when I'm hired to do something.
So now you've got, the word on Joanna Stein now is, so she put a video on YouTube, it got onto BuzzFeed, and now she got a CBS deal. It's an overnight sensation.
Just that easy. Yeah.
How easy is that? I'm going to make a video with my kid.
Yeah, I know. It was, so I'll tell you, you want to hear the story of
yeah, let's get to the truth of the matter. Yeah,
okay. I wish I was that smart. So the book came out a few months ago. When it came out, someone I knew, his name is Jed Weitzman, popped up out of the blue. Now, Jed, I knew Jed because 15 years ago, he was my first manager in town, agent type of manager. So
sure.
He actually managed me and Joy Goring, who...
And at that point, you guys have a comedy duo, you're improvising, you're writing, you're doing a lot of things.
That's right. So he was our manager way back when. Has since left the business, moved to New York, became got married, became a dad, you know, he's having a different life. So he called me up out of the blue and said, hey, I saw on Facebook, that you wrote this book. I picked it up at the store. I really like it. Has anything happened with it? Like, have you sold it to a studio? I was like, no, I'm running out to Portland to try and jam a few copies down some people's throats.
Oh.
So, he said, well, keep me posted if anything happens. But he wouldn't tell me why. I said, okay, great. So I was doing my book tour, you know, going to towns and stuff, having fun, but really, you know, selling him a book at a time. So about, I don't know, 3 months ago, he called me up and said, hey, I can tell you now, I'm running Will Arnett's new production company, and we would like to option your book and make it our first project.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, okay, yes. Yes, please. So, you know, there's a selling season for TV, and we just kind of passed it. It's kind of like August, September. And, you know, it's a frenzy. It's literally like just not, everyone's doing nonstop meetings. Studios are meeting people every 20 minutes. So
spawning seasons, the salmon spawning season for the film industry, exactly. The TV industry.
Salmon in really fancy pants and shoes. Oh,
they're beautiful, the salmon. They get all red, brightly colored and everything. It's spawning time. Come on.
Exactly right. So, okay, so we had this ready to go. Meanwhile, I have, in addition to going out and doing little book tour events around the country.
Selling a book at a time.
Exactly. I'd also been putting together these videos, to just little promotional videos, right?
So every now and then, and you're just doing that on your own, not like the publisher's giving you, hey, here's $3,000, go make a video.
Correct.
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 It's mom,
yes.
And the camera.
Exactly. Well, the first two were, you know, people. I borrowed kids from my friends, and we did one right around Mother's Day.
You're so industrious. Now, what's the return on those things? Like, how much do you get off each book you sell? Like, if you think about the amount of time you put into these videos.
Yeah.
Anyway, but I love the fact, like you said, you're just doing it. You're a maker. You make things happen. And, you know.
Well, I really enjoy the making. So for me, it's not drudgery in the slightest. And
I'm the same way. I love I'm talking to you. I love making.
Exactly. Well, that's the only way that this whole life works, in my opinion. Like, I cannot be attached to the outcome. So I don't know how many books those videos sold. Like, you know, right. The first video, Thanks Mom, I loved that one. It was so fun. I'm not in it, right? It's just these kids saying these thanks to their mothers for dubious reasons. It was just, you know, a fun thing to do, and we threw an ad at the end of it. And, you know, it got a lot of play. And maybe people, I don't know. That's the
Who
weird
knows?
Thing
you
right
don't
now.
Know, yeah.
Yeah, you don't know. You can't really quantify these things. So we did that one around Mother's Day, then another Father's Day, and then so we're back to the almost present. So I'm waiting for these meetings to happen, and I have this GoPro camera that my in-laws gave us, and David uses it a lot when he goes skiing with Sadie. They're both really good skiers, me not so much. So they ski a lot, and they, you know, film each other skiing. And one time David flipped it and filmed himself skiing down the hill. And the effect is so funny that in the back of my head, I've been thinking, I got to do something with that. It's just such a, it looks like a puppet head on popsicle sticks.
You see, that DP training has paid off. It gave you that eye to recognize that.
I guess so. Oh my God. That was, yeah. Expensive training to get to that. But anyway, so we, maybe, you know, a couple weeks before these meetings, I said to my friend Suzanne Luna, she's a dynamo. She and I shot this web series for Yahoo last year that had kind of, was spawned from, again, from this story. Cause another thing I do all the time is I cannibalize my own shit. So that essay that I said, hey, wouldn't it be fun to see how we could turn it into a video piece? So she and I figured out how to, you know, a way to do that. And we ended up doing a series. We had a great time working together. So I said to her, hey, I got this GoPro. I want to shoot something where we stick it on my head. And let's, you know, I'd like to shoot one of the chapters in the book. So we did that. I said, come on over. I don't know if it's going to work. Let's try it out. So we ran around my house. I ran around. She would hide behind pieces of furniture because that GoPro picks up everything. And we did that. And then the two of us kind of edited it back and forth because, on Final Cut, that's the beauty of Final Cut, too, is you edit it. And as long as you're sharing the footage, we each have the footage.
Yeah, you can play.
Exactly. So my goal was just to get it out before these meetings. Like, to get the video finished. So I, bare minimum, I could show it in a meeting and go, oh, isn't that funny? This is right. The tone of, you know, it would be like a little show and tell thing.
Can't you imagine that on TV, the camera on my head walking, half an hour of that, it's going to be a great show.
Well, I don't know that it's not the pitch for the television
No,
show.
I got it.
Necessarily. But yeah, we just, you know, I thought it would be a fun thing to show. And, you know, the more I edited it and looked at it. I just thought, this really is funny. And then I showed it to a couple of friends, and they said, oh, my God, do not show this to anybody before you put it up, like before you put it online. And that's where I started to get an inkling of, this is different than anything anyone's ever seen. So then I kind of got my ass into gear to get it finished. And I put it up on the Monday of the week that I had this meeting set up. And, honestly, not, I don't know how anyone could predict a viral video.
You can't.
Certainly I was not. Yeah. So, I was hoping if my friends would like it, and I showed it to these people. And instead, by like Tuesday night, it had hit BuzzFeed and was ticking up like, it was just crazy. Every time I hit refresh, it would be another like 5,000 views. It was crazy.
Oh, it just moved really fast.
Yeah. Yep. And then, the funny thing for me was the day that we had all these meetings set up, we had meetings on a Wednesday. I would go into a meeting and then get into my car, and there'd be like 50 email messages. Cause anyone who wants to find me, my email's on my website, would be like, CNN wants to talk to you. And it was just it was nonstop. Like, we're calling from Wichita. We'd love to talk to you on the radio. I'm from Australia. Can we interview you on our weekend show?
Wow.
And meanwhile, like the rest of my year, 51 weeks of the year, it's tumbleweeds. Everything was going on. So that was.
Hello, would funny. You like to buy a copy of my book? It's only $22, please.
Exactly. So the video had nothing to do with the book sale, other than when we walked into the meetings, the executives would say, hey, I saw your video on CNN this morning. That's crazy.
So you walked into that meeting with the social success of that thing, and that must have – and was that the meeting where they actually said, yeah, we're going to sign to do this sitcom?
Yeah. It actually happened like that. It was pretty crazy, and they really did say – in the room, yeah, we'd like to do this, and I kind of.
Well, they had at that point. They had to, because if they wouldn't have, you can go now. You've been on all the news, and you could go pretty much to any studio.
Right.
Your hot property. So, but now you got to stop doing everything else. I imagine. How does your life look for the next, 6 months?
Well, you're
gonna have to get a sitter. Number one, babysitter, nanny.
It's so funny that you say that, because we did just lose our nanny.
That's the worst.
She's so great. We had a, our kid is in school, so we don't need all day care. Yeah. We just, while I was working at Disney last year, we needed someone who could pick her up from school if I couldn't be there. But, she got a job working for a couple other actors who were on, shows and stuff, jetting around the world. So, yes, we'll have to do that.
That's rough.
But the next, the next 2 months are writing. So, or I think 6 weeks. It's so new. It's so fresh. I don't even understand what the schedule is, but right now it's just writing. So I get to wear my sweatpants a lot.
That is nice.
To say I'm excited about the CBS show, that's an understatement. So it's so great. It's such an exciting thing. At the same time, I've been around a lot, and the odds of success, the odds are against success for pretty much anybody who sells a pilot. That's just that's just the fact. I'm not being pessimistic or negative. That's just how it works here. The studios make a lot of pilots, and they pick up a few, and very, very few end up on TV for the long haul. So, meanwhile, I am writing this pilot, but I'm doing a bunch of other things as well, because, I don't know what's going to happen with that.
And at the same time, now you've developed this huge online audience that has an amazing cachet and a value, not only to organizations like CBS, but to people like Netflix, I mean, you never know what can happen in the ever-changing world moving videos, right? Who knows where
it's
it could
so
go.
It's so exciting. I'm so happy to be doing this stuff in this age right now, where you're making product that could land anywhere. It's such a cool time, I think, for young people.
You're young. You said that like you're.
I know. Well, let me get my knitting. It's a wonderful.
Yeah.
It's just like.
Unlike to take the listeners back. Unlike to the 25 years ago, when my friend Gary Yates, who's a film director, and I, we put together a sitcom deal with you and your sisters in comedy in Winnipeg.
That's right.
And it was actually a pretty a good idea, and we had with the whole package, and we had a Bible, and we took it to CBC in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
Because that's all we knew. We were young, and we'd never done anything like that before. And they looked at us and kind of tilted their head. Oh, this is nice. And I just think we took it to the wrong people. And then there, as you said, there was nowhere else to go. In Canada, there was CBC and CTV, and we didn't have any, the LA thing. So, and it just kind of ended there.
We would have, if that was today, we just would have shot it.
We would have made it ourselves.
We would have made it Westerners, yeah.
Yeah, but then you couldn't. It just didn't exist. You know, the technology wasn't available, and then the distribution system. If you had the technology to shoot at the distribution system to connect with an audience outside of our immediate area, wouldn't have happened either.
That's why I say that editing. I mean, writing, of course, you can't do anything without the writing, but editing, you learn how to edit, you are golden. You know.
Did you learn just by doing?
Yeah.
Just watched and did.
Yeah, well, I actually, like I said, I kind of faked my way into an editing suite. I just said, can I have access to this material? And they said, great, but you're not going to erase it, right? You know what to do with it. I was like, yeah, I'm good. So, I got a book and it was incredibly frustrating to learn, but I'm really glad I did. And it's also just a really creative activity.
Of course.
And I think a lot of people use the new iMovie right now because it's kind of a hybrid. I still use Final Cut 7.
The old Final Cut Pro.
Yeah.
And they are relatively easy to use, and you can teach yourself. And I shot a ton of my kid playing baseball. That's why I'm playing with that sort of stuff.
Oh, that's
right,
awesome.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. And my buddy Gary, the filmmaker, nice angles on that. You watching baseball on TV? And I'm like, yeah, I've been watching a lot of baseball on TV. And then I go to my kid's little league game, and I'm behind the. You gotta be careful though. I've almost got whacked a couple of times by some foul balls because you're looking at the camera, the guy in first base, to see him take a steal or something, and all of a sudden some kid nails you in the side.
Occupational hazard, yeah.
Just for some of the folks that are wondering how you got to where you got, I know the fringe festivals were a big deal for you. It was early in, I know, way back when you just got out of university, but then you kind of went back to them at a later part with the one-person show as well. Talk about how the fringe festivals sort of gave you a license to be in creative control and to play and learn.
Oh, such a great question. I love the fringe, by the way, and I'm really regretful that I didn't go this year to Winnipeg. It's just such a fantastic, if you can get into a fringe festival, just do it. For me, I think the impetus was always, I need a deadline to get anything done. I love to create stuff, but if I don't have something to focus on, some future date, even like with this Momhead video, I had this, I kind of knew I wanted to
have
a date. Yeah, like I had this, and often these deadlines are, nobody else knows about them but me, but I have some sort of internal clock going. So for me, every year that I knew I would be available in the summer, I would just, sign up to do a fringe, whether that was with Goddess Rising or with Joy, my partner in Goring and Stein, or myself. It would just be, well, I'm signing up. I have no idea what I'm going to do, but I'm going to sign up. Every year was that. Every year there would be some point at which I would be laying in the fetal position crying because I didn't feel ready, but that is just my process.
That's going to be hard on your family.
Have
you ironed that out yet?
Yeah. No, I'm a little better at it now, but
that's so funny.
But really, that is like for me when I
give yourself a deadline.
Yeah, and it's it would either be signing up for the fringe, renting a theater, signing up for a show. Like this is a lot. Essay reading is such a big thing right now. Signing up to do a show before I have a piece. Mm-hmm. I'm also a big fan of writing groups. And I've had a few different writing groups where the rule would be, we sign up, we're all going to meet on a Wednesday. Everyone's got to bring something new. You don't have to read it. If you get there, you feel bad about it, but you have to bring something new.
Talk a little bit about how did you get into your first writing group? Where was that? Was it in Los Angeles or?
Los Angeles.
Is this something you helped to create or there was an existing group and you wanted to join?
No, something I created. I'm also slightly, I lean towards working with women. I like working with guys, but I guess I like to write. A lot of the topics that I've written about have kind of been more female centric. So I do lean towards working with women. And so I would say to, I have a lot of funny friends. So it would always come to that, we'd all be saying, what are we doing? I want to do something. I'm bored. How am I going to kickstart this or that? And I'd say, I don't know. Let's just get together. Cause I love the kind of power of a group. And, you know, I'd say to my 7 funniest friends, come over to my house on a Monday, bring a snack. And, I think we didn't do alcohol because we figured out pretty quickly that
no, that's a good
would
idea.
Devolve. Yeah. But, bring a snack and we're going to, the first one, actually, I remember now was it was an anti-Valentine's Day party. That's what it was. And it was anybody who didn't have a Valentine was to come and bring something creative having to do with Valentine's Day.
And did everyone have to bring something to read out to the others?
Yeah, yep. Either something to read or a piece of art that they made or something, anything. And it could be, you know, a song. Yeah, that was the first thing. And then we had so much fun, it became a regular thing.
And I love that about you. Again, that's something that's consistent in talking to you. Is it something you needed a support network and you recognized that there was a bunch of people? So instead of waiting for something to happen, you just did it.
Yeah. Well,
this is you, Joanna Stein. You just do it. You are the embodiment of the Nike logo.
Thank you.
It's true.
Yeah.
And you're just throwing stuff out there. You know, even when you talked about the sitcom, you did talk about the failure and you got to look forward. Do you have a problem focusing, though? Does that make you sort of scattered in the sense that, okay, I'm worried this might not work, so I can't devote 100% to it just in case? Is that something that happens to you?
No, I actually have for me, working on multiple things at once is really valuable. Because what will happen is if I get into, you know, a creative corner that I can't solve, rather than, you know, like I remember feeling with the book, I would get to a place with an essay where I felt like a toothpaste tube that had been all rolled up. Like I just remember feeling a clenching in my brain where I'd have to go, I need to put this down for a second or a day.
Yeah, this is
and
it.
Focus
yeah.
on something else. And or, you know, sometimes it would be, I just need a day off. But more often than not, it would be, I need to solve a different kind of puzzle right now.
Yeah.
I'm also of the, you know, my philosophy is that this is a long game. You know, like this whole idea of overnight sensation, like that to me, it's so meaningless because there's no one moment in my creative career that is defining me. I really enjoy what I do. I hope to continue to make money doing it and just, you know, help to support my family. But it's a long game. It's just a long, game.
It's a long game. That's true. That's true. And now you've got the child who's along for the ride.
Yeah.
What did you learn? What did you learn from your parents about creating a creative space? Because I, you know, Cole's really loud. I got to tell you, people say he's a loud child. And it's because when he was young, I was amused by it. You know, he'd say something and I'd go, oh, that's so we never really told him to settle down. But now he's 8 and it's like, oh man, he's just loud. He doesn't settle down.
That's
easily.
Funny.
So I wonder about, you know, the decisions we all, in the name of creativity, we'll let him make a mess. Not that we let him write on the walls or anything like that, but, you know, I've seen parents who were that far out.
Yeah.
What kind of environment did your parents set for you that allowed you to be the creative person that you are, that you can actually sort of replicate for your own child?
Oh, wow. Well, my parents, as is well documented in this book, for better or for worse, were, you know, hippies.
Yeah.
And I, you know, there were not a lot of boundaries going on in my house. And in a good way, you guys can, you know, do whatever you want, be safe, don't hurt anybody, but use your brain and, you know, figure out what you want to do. My mom was a school teacher. She's retired now. And my dad was a history professor, also retired. So definitely writing was always a high priority. But there, you know, no one else, there's not, my brothers are both, you know, tend towards science. One brother is a biogenetic researcher. The other one is a computer genius. So it's not like, you know, I didn't come from this crazy family of artists.
Sure.
But
thinkers, but you sounds like
yeah,
thinkers.
Yeah, actually, that's exactly right. I come from a family of thinkers. And there definitely were times when I was sort of chasing the acting dream, kind of solely, and feeling a little, I don't know, ashamed is way too strong a word, but,
Like you were letting your parents down?
Yeah, not even like I was letting them down, but I really respect what everyone in my family does. And they're just, I just remember feeling like, ugh, this is not a job for a grown up. And that's always been that's kind of my constant, struggle actually,
yeah.
In that my favorite thing is acting. I love to do it. I really hate the lifestyle of it, though, of
right,
being
of course,
a around the clock, you know. So for me, writing came out of, I'm getting away from the topic, but because that actually is something I just want to talk about for a second, but in a minute. So yes, my parents were very, very open, and my mom, I think, identified pretty early on that I'm, you know, a creative type of person. And there was a moment when I was in university, and something happened in a class that really frustrated me, in an acting class or a theater class, and I got it in my head that I was going to join the Canadian military.
Wow, you really?
Yeah, I mean, I got it so far in my head that they sent me to Toronto to test to be an officer in the Air Force, and I passed, and I got a call like 3 months later to go to basic training to become an officer, and I. And
oh my goodness.
Anyway, while all this was going on, my mom was saying, come on, really? You think this is, are you, she wasn't even saying, are you sure? She was saying, this is not you. She's saying, I understand what appeals to you. And what appealed to me about it is the structure, the rigor, the, my life will be, my life will be set in that. I'm going to know what I'm doing.
And we'd assume it'd be a meritocracy, which is so difficult to understand when you're an actor. Like,
yes.
Wait a sec, you know, the meritocracy of the armed forces.
Exactly.
I kill more people, I move up the ladder.
Yes.
But going back to the question about your parents, so what did you learn from your parents that you're trying to do for your daughter? Is it working?
Well, it's funny. I'm way more controlling than my parents were.
Really?
There are more boundaries and rules. Plus, we have one kid. My parents had three.
Right.
It was
I'm the same thing. Yeah. I find at the dinner table, like sometimes I have to say to Susie, hey, let's talk. It's not about him now.
Yeah.
It's our dinner table.
Yeah.
Let's pretend. Because with the one, that's what happens. Now, how much TV do you let her watch?
Only on the weekends.
That we try to do that too. Yeah.
Yeah, we only do weekends, and actually, she does not relate to the TV at all. She gets to watch the iPad. You know, she watches Netflix. So
sure, yeah.
And she's really into Minecraft. Like that's her thing. And she thinks she wants to make video games, which I'm like, yeah, that's great, do it. She has no interest in acting, which I hate to say, but I'm kind of delighted by that. Especially in this town, you know, there's everybody.
Of course.
She has a very strange relationship to fame because, you know, we know some famous people.
Of course, it's around you.
Yeah, yeah. So she's not really affected by it. She's not impressed by it in a really great way.
Yeah. Cool. That's so exciting. And I can't wait for her to come to you one day and say, Mom, I'm going to be a singer in a rock and roll band. It's not you.
Never.
It's really not you.
Remember the video game you wanted to?
That's right.
Oh. Yeah, I whatever. I mean, I've been asked that before about her because she's actually very, very funny and is really good on camera. You know, she's actually in one of the videos or a couple of the videos that I shot before.
Yeah.
But is so bored by it. So she'll do her part. You know, I'll shoot her and then she'll be like, can I please go? Can I go play? So.
Yeah, who knows that? Who knows what's in store for these little kids?
Yeah.
Well, we got to get the families together at some point.
Oh, my gosh. That'd be great. When are you going to be here?
I have no plans to be in Los Angeles right now. I do need to. I will when you're in Canada. I know you're going to be in Winnipeg November 25th,
yes.
Jumping the book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Where are you doing that in Winnipeg?
McNally-Robinson.
McNally-Robinson, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, Joanna, it's so nice to hook up. And I was so when I saw the fact that the video was picked up on BuzzFeed. I mean, I teach at Western. I teach social media. And it's so cool to talk to someone who's actually been through the process.
The interesting thing is going to be for me to see, you know, in 6 months or whenever I find out what the sales are, how this has affected the book. You know,
absolutely.
It's funny because I really don't know that there's a solid way to quantify. I mean, if it ended up on the New York Times bestseller list tomorrow, then yeah, I would say it had an effect. But it'll be interesting. I'll keep you posted anyway.
Well, good luck 6 months. I'm very curious to see if it had an impact on, because in my social media class, we do talk about the power of social media to sell things. And it is phenomenal. And it's amazing, you know, the first time I asked my students, I said, everyone put up your hand if you've bought something online in the last week, and like 80% of the class have put up their hand.
Yeah.
And I'm a crazy guy. Like, I bought my winter tires on, not on social media, but online, and you know.
Yeah.
So it is the future for sure. So good luck with the book sales. Good luck with the TV show. That's so exciting.
Thank
the sitcom.
You.
It, when do you think it actually, when does it actually have to be finished? Because I know you love a deadline.
I actually don't have a solid deadline, but I believe it's we'll have to have a script finished before I go to Winnipeg. So 6 weeks.
Wow, you got to really turn the script around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's how it works. That's the typical sitcom deadline.
Because and you're starting with nothing but the book.
Yeah.
Wow. Good luck.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Good luck. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Good talking to you.
Great talking to you.
Well, there you go, Johanna Stein. 6 weeks to write a sitcom pilot. Amazing, eh? And think about it. You know, if it works, some sitcoms go on for years. Some sitcoms never get on at all. Some sitcom pilots just don't even see the light of day. So best of luck to Joanne and her colleagues in Los Angeles. She is going to be at McNally Robinson in November in Winnipeg. So if you're there, check it out. And if you can, before I go, I'm going to ask you for a favor. Visit the iTunes store, and in the iTunes search box, type in The Inadequate Life. That's the name of my podcast here, The Inadequate Life. You'll see the actual podcast site on iTunes, and there's a box there for reviews and ratings on the left-hand side. Just click, if you can, ratings, and give us a rating from 1 to 5 stars. Anything helps. If you have a little bit of time and you want to write something funny in the spirit of Joanna Stein, you could leave a little review, a couple of sentences is great. The reason I ask you to do that is the more people that give us ratings and reviews, the higher we'll show up in the search engine when someone is looking for a podcast on iTunes about the creative process. So hopefully, Joanna's story has inspired you to buckle down, do some writing, forget about trying to be funny, purge on the page, and then figure it out later. That's the way I'm leaving it today. Purge on the page, and then edit after that. It's Keith Tomasek. Thanks so much for listening. Come back on another Monday for another episode of The Inadequate Life.